Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Texan Norma McCorvey died last month, 44 years after her pseudonym Jane Roe became a household name. McCorvey's lawsuit seeking to end her third unwanted pregnancy went to the Supreme Court as Roe v. Wade. She spent years celebrating the decision that gave American women a constitutional right to abortion in every state, and then she decided she'd been wrong. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. In the mid-90s, McCorvey broke with left-leaning feminism, embraced Christianity, and became a symbol on the right of the power of redemption. McCorvey's story is perhaps not so remarkable in a country still divided over abortion rights. Moira Donegan's recent piece for The New Republic described her as an enticing mark for both sides of the abortion debate. And she joined us from the studios of NPR in New York to talk about her piece and McCorvey's life. You can find a link to the essay, What the Culture Wars Did to Norma McCorvey, at think.kera.org. And you can join the conversation this hour on Twitter. Our handle is at KERAThink. Moira, welcome to Think.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
What was Norma McCorvey's early life like?
Well, it was pretty horrific. She was born in northern Louisiana in the 1940s, and she was the child of a very poor pair of parents. Her mother, Mary, was divorced from her father pretty early in her life, and she wound up being terribly abused by her mother physically, by another relative sexually, and her brother also had some mental difficulties that made life at home pretty difficult for Norma. She ran away the first chance she could. Earlier than that, she would actually steal and deliberately get caught stealing so that she could be sent away to reform school, which she preferred to being at home.
Hmm. Why did she want an abortion in 1969, and what did she do to try and get one?
It was actually Norma McCorvey's third pregnancy in 1969. She had been pregnant once before when she was about 16. That first child was a daughter that her mother tricked her into relinquishing custody of. Her second pregnancy resulted in a child who was given away for adoption. And by the time she got pregnant for the third time, she had been already divorced from an abusive husband. She was homeless. She was struggling with drug and alcohol addictions, as well as suicidal depression. And she has said that she didn't feel capable of going through another pregnancy and another childbirth to give the child away again. It seemed like too much pain for her. So McCorvey at the time was living in Dallas, and she actually went to what she knew to be an illegal clinic that offered abortions in sort of a clandestine way, and she found that that clinic had been shut down. It was shut down just a few weeks before she went there. And so she went to an attorney who had handled her previous adoption case when she gave birth for the second time, and was referred by that lawyer to Sarah Weddington and Linda Coffey, who were a pair of women's rights lawyers who were looking for a test case to try their opposition to Texas's abortion ban.
And just to be clear, Norma McCorvey, her case was the one that changed abortion law for women all over the country, but the ruling from the Supreme Court came too late for her. That third pregnancy that we're talking about, she bore a term and then put that child up for adoption.
That's right. She gave birth to a daughter in 1970, and was very disappointed, actually, when she realized that her case wouldn't have a ruling in time for her to have an abortion.
Hmm. So abortion laws at the time, state laws that permitted it and state laws that banned it, they were, I guess, a patchwork around the country back then?
Yeah. In similar ways to today, the restrictions on abortion and conditions under which abortions may be and must be performed were very different, and they varied state to state, sometimes county to county. McCorvey was not able to obtain a legal abortion, partly because she wasn't able to travel to one of the several states where abortion was permitted on demand at the time, places like New York. She just didn't have the money to get there.
What made Coffey and Weddington think that McCorvey's case was ideal as a test case, if you want to use that word, for the Supreme Court to consider the constitutional right to abortion?
Well, they knew that they needed somebody who was currently pregnant, who had attempted to have an illegal abortion and had been denied. But she wasn't a very ideal case because she was not a very empathetic character. You know, at the time she had been homeless, she'd been selling and abusing drugs, she had at various points in her life dabbled in a cult religion, and when she was young she was primarily lesbian, so she wasn't empathetic in a public way. So when she said that she wanted to retain her anonymity and be known in the case not as Norma McCorvey but as Jane Roe, Coffey and Weddington didn't see too much of a problem with that. They were entirely content to protect her anonymity and to move forward with her as an emblem more than somebody whose actual interests could be protected.
And it wasn't like she went with them to the Supreme Court. By the time they were arguing her case, they had lost touch.
That's right. She learned about the decision in the newspaper.
What persuaded her to reveal her identity in the 80s?
Well, it's interesting because after the Roe v. Wade decision, abortion providers and abortion patients became under a lot of attacks. There was vitriol against them. There was some degree of violence happening at abortion clinics, as still periodically happens today. And McCorvey, who had had a life that was full of a lot of suffering, a lot of denial of her own worth, really saw herself as an agent of history. She said later that being the Jane Roe of the Roe v. Wade decision was the thing that made her feel closest, most like a person. So she had a sense of mission and purpose, as well as sort of a real shock at how much anger was directed towards people who were trying to obtain abortions. So she became very passionate about the cause, and in the 80s, worked for an abortion clinic in Dallas. She attended many marches and rallies. She was very passionately pro-choice.
How did she fare as the sort of poster child for reproductive rights?
She felt very alienated by the leadership of the women's movement, which by that time had become this very PR-conscious, large, mainstream organization led by women who had quite a bit more education than her, who were by and large not from the South, who had a different class background. She didn't feel like she fit in. And she felt like she was being rejected by mainstream feminism for the same reasons that Waddington and Coffey were pretty content to have her be anonymous, because she wasn't a figure that they could sell.
Yeah. So she was working, as you mentioned, for a while as a counselor at an abortion clinic in Dallas. What other organizations were officing in that neighborhood?
Well, there was also Operation Rescue, which opened up its headquarters for a very impassioned anti-abortion campaign directly next door. Flip Benham, who was the pastor who led Operation Rescue, made a very deliberate decision to open up right next door to an abortion clinic, and to do so in particular at a clinic that employed one of the most potent symbols of the abortion rights movement.
So it seems like such a strange friendship that formed between Flip Benham and Norma McCorvey, at least given her position at the time. How did they become friendly?
You know, they weren't friendly for quite some time. They actually met at first when McCorvey had published her first memoir. She wrote two, and the first one was named I Am Roe. And she was on a book tour during the phase of her life when she was very pro-abortion. And Benham showed up at one of her book signings with a whole bunch of protesters yelling that she was responsible for the murder of, I think he said, 33 million children. I think she rightly felt very antagonized by Benham and refused to speak to him for a long time. But, you know, she was active in women's rights protest movements at the time, and he was often there with the Operation Rescue followers counter-protesting. So they would run into each other quite a bit, and they were working in the same neighborhood in Dallas. So she would eventually start making small talk with him and going over to the Operation Rescue offices to hang out on her smoke breaks. There's a really amazing story about how they bonded over their shared love of the Beach Boys.
So gradually she experienced this change of heart, and among evangelicals who celebrated that, suddenly her past was something to be celebrated, right? It was like, I guess, her many sins demonstrated the magnitude of her redemption from that perspective.
Exactly. See, what the abortion rights advocates who she had been working with before had to say to the public was, we're not bad people, we're good people, we want to live honest lives, which made somebody with a past like McCorvey's, which was full of a lot of compromises, a lot of ethical gray areas, not an entirely compelling story for them to tell. But for the Christian movement that Flip Benham and the Operation Rescue folks were trying to advocate for, a sinner was actually a very valuable commodity. You know, it was a kind of a big score because they could demonstrate Jesus's forgiveness through the tale of this person who had lived a very difficult life, a very sinful life, and come into redemption through God.
So she had this swimming pool baptism. Literally, I'm not using some derogatory term. She had a baptism in a swimming pool. Later, she converted to Catholicism, and she renounced same-sex relationships. Did she end her own same-sex relationship?
She did not. She continued to live with her partner, Connie Gonzalez, in Dallas until about 2004. Accounts of the end of their relationship differ. But she was very publicly Christian, was very publicly espousing many of the positions of the Christian movement on social issues, on gay rights and women's rights issues. But, you know, she lived a very complicated life, and the way that she understood her own life didn't always jive with the politics that she was expressing.
Was she able to say what changed in her life that caused her perspective to be so very different on this issue?
Her own accounts of the change are not very well articulated. This is somebody who didn't have a lot of education, who had been searching for acceptance. And when she gave accounts of her own transformation, was tending to emphasize things like disrespect she felt from the women's movement, things like her own sense of aggrieved personal value. So her own account is varied and a little contradictory. What I think is interesting about McCorvey is that, you know, abortion politics are so fraught with emotion on both sides. And she always had a very powerfully emotional stance, even when she had opposite opinions.
Her story is really fascinating because regardless of the position you take on reproductive rights or a pro-life position, it's hard not to empathize with how Norma McCorvey must have felt at these different points in her life.
She's a very compelling figure. She was manipulated very easily. She had a lot of different ideas at once, and in part this is because she was a bit of a naive person. She was an undereducated person. She was a person who had suffered a lot and was looking for acceptance. But it's also partly because she had a degree of emotional intelligence, right? Like, you can see in her story a person who managed to see both sides of a very divisive issue and to feel them both very intensely. And I think that's really compelling for a lot of people.
So I have to imagine she was the star attraction at a lot of events held first by pro-choice groups, then by pro-life groups. Why did she continue to struggle financially?
She had a series of personal problems that are difficult to really historically construct, but not difficult to empathize with on an emotional level. So she was not entirely employable because of her lack of education, because of some medical issues that arose later in her life. She did sell 2 books and was charging $1,000 for an interview up until the very end of her life. So she lived largely off of donations and off of speaking and writing engagements.
Do you happen to know whether she ever had contact with the children that she bore but did not raise?
Her first child was raised by her mother, and she had contact with that daughter, who has chosen to remain anonymous. The other 2 children, her second and third children, were adopted by couples who chose to remain anonymous as well.
Moira, what do you think we should make of Norma McCorvey's life and the meaning of it?
A lot of times the emotional resonance of these debates gets boiled down to conservatives being hard-headed and practical and liberals being compassionate. And abortion kind of flips that script on its head. It's a way for conservatives to be liberal and for liberals to be very practical and pragmatic. And McCorvey blows all that up. She just defies all of our expectations of what it means to be a conservative or a liberal or a oppressor or an oppressed person or a Christian or a lesbian. You know, she makes me realize that our politics doesn't account for how complicated people's lives really are.
Moira, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Moira Donegan profiled Norma McCorvey for The New Republic. You can read her piece at think.kera.org. Up next, we'll talk with a researcher who looked into how certain women are about their decisions to seek an abortion.
The questions about women's emotional responses to abortion and all the heightened public concern around that are really based on an idea that women don't actually know what they're doing in terms of abortion and aren't sure of their decision. And in fact, they're more sure than they are when they are making other healthcare decisions.
And we'll talk with the founder of an organization whose members describe themselves as pro-life feminists.
And I think a lot of even pro-life people my age, I'm in my 30s, we're so sick of being anti-everything. We're anti-abortion, anti-Planned Parenthood. What if we were for alternatives for women?
We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking today about abortion, which remains both a personal decision and a public debate more than four decades after its legalization. You can join the conversation on Twitter at KERATHINK. A recent study asked 500 women seeking abortions in Utah about how sure they were of their decision. 92% said they were confident in their choice to terminate the pregnancy. Sarah Roberts is a public health social scientist at UC San Francisco. She's one of the authors of the study, which appeared in the journal Contraception, and she joined us from the studios of Reveal in Oakland. Sarah, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
What made you want to know just how sure women are when they seek to end their pregnancies?
We decided to look at this as part of a larger study that we were doing about women's experiences with a new law in Utah that required women to wait 72 hours before having an abortion and also to make two visits to an abortion clinic before having an abortion. One of the reasons that we decided to look to see how sure women were was that in the larger study that we were doing, we found that how sure women were when they first presented for care was the biggest factor that explained whether or not they had the abortion by the time we followed up with them. We found that the vast majority of women in our preliminary look at how sure they were sure of their decision. 92% of them expressed that they were confident in their decision. And so we wanted to look at that in more depth to really understand how sure women were.
So you talked to them at the start of this 72-hour waiting period, and then you talked to them again after that time had elapsed. Is that right?
Yeah. So what we did for our study was we recruited women when they presented for their first required visit, so the state-mandated abortion information visit. We recruited them when they presented for care at four different facilities in Utah. And they completed an iPad survey by themselves, and then we called them 3 weeks later to find out whether or not they had had an abortion and asked them what the experience of waiting had been like and assessed a whole number of other factors in relation to costs, people that they had to disclose to, things along those lines.
How many of them went through with it?
By the time we followed up with them, 86% had had an abortion, 8% were no longer seeking an abortion, 3% had miscarried or discovered they had not been pregnant, 2% were still seeking an abortion, one woman was still making her decision, and one woman had been unable to have an abortion because of the waiting period. If she had been able to have the abortion when she first presented for care, or had she only had to wait 24 hours, she would have been under the gestational limit at the facility where she sought care. So to state this in a slightly more clear way, the vast majority of women were sure of their decision when they first presented for care and had an abortion by the time we followed up with them.
How does conventional wisdom about this great regret that women are expected to feel after an abortion shape the way we think about the emotional ramifications of the procedure?
Let me actually answer the question in terms of just certainty first, because I think that there's an assumption that women are unsure of their decision by the time they presented for care. And I think that what we actually found was that women are incredibly sure. So what we did was, for the study that we're talking about, is that we looked at a scale. We used a scale that's been used in a variety of other healthcare settings to see how sure people are in terms of their healthcare decisions. So it's been used in relation to people making decisions about mastectomy, about prenatal testing after infertility. And what we found when we looked at how sure women were about their abortion decision was that they were more sure than people making these other healthcare decisions. I think that the questions about women's emotional responses to abortion and all the heightened public concern around that are really based on an idea that women don't actually know what they're doing in terms of abortion and aren't sure of their decision. And in fact, they're more sure than they are when they are making other healthcare decisions.
Do abortion providers typically try to assess their patients' certainty about this procedure any more carefully than they would for other elective medical procedures?
My understanding is that that is what the recommended practice is in terms of the National Abortion Federation. Their clinical practice guidelines recommend that providers assess women's certainty about their decisions and give some guidance about how to do so.
Being in Utah, your study included a much higher proportion of women who identified as Mormons, members of the LDS Church, than the general U.S. population. Did belonging to a religion that forbids abortion make women any less certain of their decision to have one than any other women?
Mormons were less certain about their decision when they first presented for care than women without a religion. What that means in terms of thinking about how this generalizes to other places is that in places where there are fewer Mormons, women may be actually even more certain about their decision than they were in Utah.
For those who actually did not obtain abortions, were there some who might have done so had it been easier to get back to the clinic? Were you able to ascertain that?
That was one of our key questions of, for the women who do not have abortions, what are the reasons that they haven't had an abortion? And the most common reason was really their own decision-making, that in fact, they were conflicted or still in the process of making their decision when they first presented for care and then decided not to have an abortion. Another common reason was the financial and logistical hassles of getting back. For other women, it was that other people came through for them. So their boyfriend got their act together, or a family member stepped up and said that they would be willing to help. So there were a number of different reasons and factors that played in. But I would say that the biggest reason that women themselves described and that we found when we did a more quantitative analysis was that it was really their own decision-making and how sure they were when they first presented for care that predicted who was going to have an abortion by the time we followed up with them. But to flip that around, I think is actually the story that is worth emphasizing, which is the vast majority had made their decision and then went on to implement it. There was a small proportion who were conflicted when they first presented for care, and about half of those who were conflicted ended up having an abortion by the time we followed up with them, and half did not, whereas 98% of those who were not conflicted had had an abortion by the time we followed up with them.
Have you thought about following up with these same women, say, 6 months from now, a year from now, 3 years from now? And what could you learn if you asked at that point if they still were equally comfortable with their decision?
We have not thought about that because the way that research works is you make a decision at the beginning about how long you're going to follow up with people. So you can't go back and retroactively reach out to them again. But colleagues of mine have done extensive research to look at how much they think that the decision that they made was the correct one. So there's a larger study that my colleague Diana Green Foster has led that follows women who were seeking abortion for 5 years. And as part of that study, one of the questions that she has looked at and that we have looked at is whether or not women who had an abortion think it was the right decision for them. And they get asked that question every 6 months. And the data that have been published so far follow women through 3 years, and more than 95% consistently think that it was the right decision for them over that time period.
Sarah, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
That was Sarah Roberts, a researcher at UC San Francisco. You can find a link to her study at think.kera.org. A woman's autonomy over her own body is one of the pillars of feminism. And Destiny Herndon De La Rosa, founder of Dallas-based New Wave Feminists, proudly defines herself as one. But the group is different than other feminist organizations because its members espouse a pro-life position. She joined us to talk about her organization's mission, not to change abortion laws, but to reduce the factors that lead women to choose not to carry unwanted pregnancies to term. Destiny, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your organization subscribes to what you call a consistent life ethic. Explain what falls under that definition.
Yeah, so basically it's this belief that human beings should be free from violence for the duration of their life. So that ends up meaning we are anti-war, anti-torture, anti-death penalty, and then we just extend that into the womb by being anti-violence when we are at our most weak and vulnerable as a fetus. But of course that puts us in a very weird spectrum because we agree with a lot of people on the left, but also a lot of people on the right. And it's just a matter of trying to broaden everyone's idea of what consistent nonviolence means.
Was there a point at which you struggled with the fact that you had a lot of beliefs that sort of tracked with mainstream feminism, but you also disagreed with abortion?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think the best part of, feminism for me is it's a movement born out of rebellion and independence. And so being able to have an idea that's different, I think completely fits with what we're talking about. And so as I kind of wore the label of feminist and started putting it out there, I found so many women who had said, I never thought that I could call myself a feminist, but even though I agree, lock and step with everything except for the abortion issue. And so we're seeing that now that we are very public about the fact that pro-life feminism is a thing. It's not an oxymoron like everyone believes. We have just women coming out of the woodwork saying, how can we work with you? And we don't just focus on, you know, in the pro-life movement, you call it like the fetal tunnel vision and just focusing on that. But we really want to address, why do women feel like they need to make this violent choice to begin with? Like, why are they so pressured that abortion seems like the best option? And I think one thing that we can agree with pro-choice feminists as well is nobody wants an abortion. You know, it's not like when you're a little girl, you grow up dreaming about having an abortion. It's usually always a decision made out of fear and panic and chaos. And so if we can come together and say, how do we alleviate that crisis? How do we help a woman where she's at so that she can make life-affirming options? I think that's something we can all rally behind.
You are not working to make abortion illegal.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't know. I mean, I know that there's plenty of pro-life groups who are, but for me, it's a matter of laws follow culture. And until we have a culture that values human life inside the womb, all you're going to do is run it underground. And so for me personally, I think the efforts need to be working for something. And I think a lot of even pro-life people my age, I'm in my 30s, we're so sick of being anti-everything. We're anti-abortion, anti-Planned Parenthood. What if we were for alternatives for women? I live here in Dallas. I'm an uninsured woman. And so when you talk about taking away Planned Parenthood, I personally don't go there, but I can absolutely understand why so many women would be afraid of not having alternative health care. And so I think it's so much more important that we're actually working towards offering alternatives rather than just taking away a form of health care that a lot of women feel very dependent on.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. To the extent that unwanted pregnancies still occur, what can pro-life feminists or anybody do to support women who are pregnant and not in a position to raise a child?
You know, I think a lot of it is telling a woman she can do this. You are strong enough. You can do this. I actually faced a teen pregnancy myself when I was 16 years old. And I had many friends who chose abortion while I chose to carry to term. And for the first 6 months, I considered adoption. And it's funny when people say I'm anti-choice because I'm like, that's all I felt like I had was choices. Even though abortion was never an option for me, there were so many things that I had to consider during that nine-month period. And then I had these friends who became pregnant as well, and they were going to be kicked out of their homes. Not only were they not going to have a support system once they had the child, but even the support system they currently had, they were at a risk of losing. It's more than voting a certain way or having a bumper sticker. It's really a matter of putting your time and talents where your beliefs are and helping that woman and saying, you know what, I have a spare room in my house. If you need a place to stay, we're going to help you. If you need help getting on some sort of Medicaid for the duration of the pregnancy, we're going to help you. And I think that more of the pro-life community is waking up about that. We cannot just be pro-fetus. We have to be pro-woman and actually helping a woman in this time of crisis.
There is a stigma to being pregnant when people around you know that you didn't intend to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't want to say it's going away, but I think that if the pro-life activists realize how much pressure and shame there is, you know, when I was the 16-year-old girl, I remember I became pregnant right before summer break. So when I came back, I had this huge belly and I was just walking the halls and people were whispering and talking about me. And there was so much shame in that, whereas there wouldn't have been a ton of shame in choosing abortion because no one would have known that it had taken place. And so if we can empower women who are facing something that there is certainly a stigma to, and it is really embarrassing, and come alongside them, you know, so that they know they have somewhere to turn, I think that's vital in making a case for life.
Given the choice that you made, do you judge women who have made a different decision?
Absolutely not. Because again, I mean, I know that I had a support system. Some of them didn't. My boyfriend broke up with me, so I was single, but I still had family support, which I think that is so incredibly vital. And as I mentioned, I had peers who made the choice for abortion because they felt like they had no other choice. To me, that's a problem. You know, when we call that pro-choice, but women are feeling coerced or forced into this choice. And a lot of times, if they are given support or other options, they make better choices.
Do you feel welcome at general feminist events? Lots of people talked about the women's marches that took place around the country being not so friendly to pro-life feminists.
Yeah.
You know, it was actually our group that was a partner for that and got removed. And so the irony is you talk about inclusion and diversity. And so when we filled out the application to become a partner, we made it very clear that we were pro-life. But we said, here are some other issues that we also agree with you guys on, talking about human trafficking and domestic abuse and the wage gap and things that we can actually address together. And so they accepted us, which we thought was amazing. Then a few days later, The Atlantic came out with an article kind of praising them for including pro-life feminists. And that's when there was this big Twitter backlash from some pro-choice feminists saying, you know, you need to remove them. They absolutely can't be a part of this march. And something really cool happened from that because we still went anyway. But basically, there was this national dialogue for about a week, I think, you know, around a lot of dinner tables of who's allowed to be in our club, who's allowed to, you know, sit at our feminist table. And so we had women come up to us at the Women's March in Washington. I pulled out my pro-life feminist sign very, you know, apprehensively. And within about 45 seconds of having it, and it's a sign that says, I'm a pro-life feminist, and, you know, hot pink and black lettering, this woman walks up to me and she said, I disagree with you on this issue, but I am so glad you're here. They should have never cut you from the partners list. And that repeated person after person after person. And it blew my mind, honestly, because, you know, that morning I talked to my husband and he's like, okay, remember you have children and who are you going to call if, you know, something goes down? And it was the exact opposite. I could not have imagined a more positive experience than my fellow feminists coming around me and saying, you know, we need you in this fight. We're facing an administration that I think a lot of us are very concerned about. The misogyny in Donald Trump's past has no place in the future of America. And so we need more women in this fight together.
Is it possible to be politically pro-choice and personally pro-life?
You know, I think it's a very nuanced issue. So certainly, I know in the pro-life movement, something that bothers me is everyone referring to the other side as pro-abortion. I don't think a lot of people are pro-abortion, honestly. Most of the people I meet say, I personally would never have an abortion, but I don't feel like I should put that on another woman and take away her rights. I think that's definitely something I can work with. What if you aren't taking away her rights? What if you're offering her support so she can make that life-affirming choice? You know, again, I think there's so much common ground in the fact that ultimately both sides care very, very deeply about women and children. And if we could just find ways to work together rather than working against one another, I think that'll be progress for all of us.
Destiny, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Destiny Herndon De La Rosa is a founder of New Wave Feminists. Coming up, we'll talk with a woman who had an abortion about why she's choosing to be open about her experience.
I think it's really important to create a new context in which we can have open conversations and not have to like watch the way we're talking about it or say certain words or not say certain words because we're going to offend people. I think it's time to have a space to talk openly.
That's when Think continues.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking today about the decision women make to have a baby or to have an abortion when they face an unexpected pregnancy. You can join the conversation on Twitter at KERAThink. Earlier in the show, we talked about the conflicted life of Norma McCorvey, who died last month. She's better known as Jane Roe of the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court case legalizing abortion. McCorvey never actually had an abortion, though she worked in abortion clinics following her court case. Later in life, she underwent a religious conversion and joined the pro-life movement. Here she is talking with Ted Koppel on Nightline in 1995, shortly after she announced her change of heart.
You said in passing a moment ago that you felt you had already been used too much. Used by whom? To what end?
Well, I've been shunned by quite a few of the national leaders in the pro-choice movement. I really get this really strong hit that people think that I'm just like totally stupid, and I'm not. I mean, I've got brains and I have ideas, and I just don't really feel like they hear me. And I mean, I'm not that Vassar quality, you know. I'm a street kid. I'm an ex-alcoholic. I'm an ex-drug dealer. I'm an ex-drug addict, you know. So, I mean, I wasn't their chosen one to be their special Jane Roe. But what I'm saying is that they just never gave me the respect that I thought that I deserved.
Let me try and present what might be, I mean, I doubt very much that you'll ever hear this in public from them, but what might be their point of view. You're not, and you've just sort of outlined the reasons yourself when you talk about your own background, you're not exactly the ideal role model, right?
Right.
So are you surprised that they didn't choose then to invite you, to sort of put you up front and say, here's our poster gal?
Let me explain to you this other way, Ted. And back in 1969, when I lied and I told Sarah Weddington and Linda Coffey that I had been raped, I did that out of pure desperation. I wanted to have an abortion. I saved up my rent money. I went to an illegal abortion clinic here in Dallas, Texas. I saw the conditions of that clinic. I saw the dry blood on the floor. I saw all the roaches and all the other creepy things crawling around the floor. The only thing that stopped me was the fact that the clinic had been busted a week before that. That was the only thing that stopped me.
McCorvey's complicated relationship to abortion and the movement surrounding it continues to play out today. Growing up, Cassie Underwood never imagined she would have an abortion. Then she found herself pregnant at 19 and realized she was unprepared for the responsibilities of pregnancy or motherhood. She joined us from a studio on the campus of Harvard to talk about her path of self-discovery since then, which she writes about in her new memoir, May Cause Love, An Unexpected Journey of Enlightenment After Abortion. Cassie, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before you became pregnant yourself, how much thought had you given to abortion?
I had given a fair amount of thought in that I never wanted to have one. It was like my greatest fear. And I had grown up around these anti-abortion billboards and a little bit of anti-abortion thought and messaging. And I just never, ever wanted to have one growing up before I had one.
Did you find yourself surprised that it suddenly became something that you were thinking a lot about?
I was shocked to be pregnant. I was shocked to have to think about abortion. But it was also the first thought that came to mind when I found out that I was pregnant, other than like, oh my God, this is terrible.
Most women who've had abortions choose to stay pretty private about it. You've made the choice to tell your story publicly. Can you talk about the process by which you came to the decision that you would talk about this?
Yeah, it was a really short process. It was like I walked into the clinic and I said, I'm never, ever going to talk about this. And then I walked out of the clinic and I said, I'm never going to stop talking about this, because I never want another woman to feel as alone as I had felt during those 3 weeks leading up to my abortion.
In hindsight, your boyfriend at the time was with you for the procedure, but you realized that you were kind of alone in carrying the weight of the decision with you.
Yeah, I really felt that way. And he was in a really different place. I was drinking a lot before I found out I was pregnant, and then I stopped as soon as I received the positive pregnancy test. And he continued to be using drugs, and it just felt like we were in different worlds.
How seriously did you think as you were making your decision about possibly carrying the pregnancy to term?
I thought about it, and I considered the possibility. My mom offered for me to move home, but she also left the decision up to me. Ultimately, it was just a gut feeling. As soon as I found out that the circumstances that I was in, they were so not going to be conducive to a child, to bringing a child into the world. And it was kind of a process of having that gut feeling and then looking at all the options, because I thought there's no way that I would want to have an abortion. I always said I never would. And so thinking about becoming a mother was part of that process. It had been part of my process throughout my life, thinking about becoming a mother. And so I thought about it seriously for years beforehand and during the pregnancy.
What was it like to tell your parents that you chose to have an abortion?
It was a total accident. I definitely did not want to hurt them, and I didn't want them to know that I was pregnant. But I called my mom. I just wanted to hear her voice and just for comfort. And as soon as she got on the phone, she said, "What's wrong?" And I started crying. And my dad in the background said, "She's pregnant, isn't she?" Hmm. And my mom said, "Are you pregnant?" And I said, "I'm so sorry." And I think that they were just devastated. It was like our collective worst nightmare for me to be pregnant. I was in college and I was trying to build a life for myself outside of home, and it was just a nightmare.
You write that you blamed alcohol in deciding not to carry the pregnancy to term and choose adoption. Can you explain what you mean by that phrase?
Yeah, so I had been pregnant for at least 5 weeks before I found out that that I was pregnant. And those are really a sensitive time during a pregnancy. And so I figured it wasn't just drinking that I was doing. I was really using drugs and not treating my body in the way that I would want to treat my body if I knew I was pregnant and having a child. And so it felt like I had already done this. I'd already done damage.
Were you surprised at how often you thought about the abortion after the procedure was over?
Not really, because I had thought about becoming a mother so often when I was growing up. It was like foremost on my mind when I was a child. And so it made sense to me that I would think about it a lot. What didn't make sense to me is that 1 in 3 women will have an abortion in her lifetime, approximately, and that nobody was talking about it.
Something you didn't know at the time of your abortion was that other cultures have rituals surrounding it. Can you talk about what they do in Japan?
Yeah, they have a ritual called Mizuko Kuyo, and it started hundreds of years ago by women who experienced abortion, and they would gather on the roadside and scrub this statue of a bodhisattva named Jizo. And Jizo was the bodhisattva, the guardian of children who had passed on. But now that it's come to the United States, it was more of just, you know, I met with a priest, a Buddhist priest in a Buddhist church in New York City, and he took me through a ritual of honoring the pregnancy.
Other rituals or things that you engaged in were harder. You went to a Catholic retreat, and of course, people are probably aware that Catholic doctrine is categorically opposed to abortion. What was the experience?
Well, the experience was a lot of things. I spent the time there. I didn't expect it to be quite as dogmatically anti-abortion in that setting as it was. What stands out to me, really, I mean, I could tell you a lot about the priest who took me out on the lawn in front of the seminary where it was being held and pulled a plastic fetus out of his pocket and invited me to confess, and I could even confess murder, he told me. And that was unfortunate. But I think that really what it taught me, if I really looked at myself during that time, is that I was judging them for judging me. And so I learned that I was projecting my own kind of darkness and shadow side onto these people who were just living out their own beliefs, and I had walked into their territory.
Your boyfriend at the time was a year older than you. As you mentioned, he had some drug and alcohol issues. How did his fitness to be a parent or not play into your decision, if at all?
It's really hard to tell because, like I said, it was just like a gut feeling, but I think that probably a lot. You know, if he had said, let's have this baby, I probably would have given it more thought. But it seemed to me like the decision was really whether I was going to be a single mom or have an abortion.
You have said that the pro-choice, pro-life debate simply doesn't work. Talk about why it doesn't work.
I think that, well, one really obvious issue is that women who've experienced abortion are on both sides of the debate. And both movements are using women's stories to advance their arguments that abortion should be legal or illegal. And who are we supposed to believe? Like, whose story do we give more credibility to? And I think that we need to give credibility to all the stories and deal, if we're dealing with abortion, I think we need to start dealing at the level of cause and we're dealing at the level of effect. There's no winning in that. Nobody's going to win a war played out at the level of effect. So we really need to come together, especially people who've experienced abortion, and just listen to each other and believe each other and support each other, no matter what side we're on politically.
Who do you think is hurt by the proliferation of this debate?
Who is hurt by it?
Yeah.
I think that definitely the millions of people who've experienced abortion and been forgotten because they don't fit into either side. There's really not been a huge context or space to talk about abortion outside of the political life. And I think it's really important to create a new context in which we can have open conversations and not have to like watch the way we're talking about it or say certain words or not say certain words because we're going to offend people. I think it's time to have a space to talk openly.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking today with Cassie Underwood, author of May Cause Love, An Unexpected Journey of Enlightenment After Abortion. Is it possible to be certain you've made the right decision and also be very sad that you had to make it at the same time?
Well, in my experience, it is. And I have moments, you know, I don't think about it as much anymore, but I thought about it a lot for a long time, my abortion. And I did have moments where I felt like so certain, and I also felt so sad. And going and trying to make sense of that when sadness is historically considered an anti-abortion sentiment around abortion, like it was complicated and it was confusing and it felt really lonely to me.
There are women starting to tell stories of their abortions, but often they are stories that are, if you'll forgive the word, sort of justified by, you know, an explanation that there was something wrong, something severely wrong in the pregnancy. Do you think more women who had abortions because they weren't ready to raise a child should say that out loud?
What I really hope is that people who've experienced abortion can talk to each other. The need to say it to a public audience, that matters. But what really matters is that we connect with one another, I think. And people who've experienced abortion should tell their story if they feel moved to do that. But they also shouldn't feel obliged to tell their story. And I hope that we'll all, I think it's scarier actually to tell it to somebody one-on-one than it is to tell it publicly. So I hope that we'll start creating spaces one-on-one where people can say that they had an abortion just because they weren't ready or didn't want to be pregnant and feel welcomed and loved.
What kind of reception have you had from people who've heard your story or read your writing about it?
The truth is that, I mean, what happens a lot of times is that people just go back to, like, the debate around it. And that's unfortunate. But my favorite thing is when somebody who's had an abortion reaches out to me and tells me what they've had felt like they had to hide, including if they've been a public speaker for a pro-choice organization or something like that. And they write me and they say, you know, but on like privately, I'm dealing with this and I just can't say it publicly. Or somebody who is pro-life or anti-abortion writes me and said, I had an abortion and I feel like I have to pretend to be selfish or feel selfish about it. So that's my, you know, that's what really matters to me is hearing from people who can have a place to tell the truth.
It's strange that we have this expectation on top of everything else, whatever people's positions are, we have an expectation that there's a certain way that women are supposed to feel about this.
Definitely. There's like the narrative that, I mean, it's very politically based. So it's the narrative that somebody's supposed to feel sad and selfish. And then that's the anti-abortion and regret their decision. And then there's the narrative that somebody's supposed to just feel relieved and grateful. And it's possible to feel all those. And it's also possible to have a shifting and ongoing experience. It happens. And then life goes on and different life events unfold. So my story's changed a lot. It changes all the time.
You're in your early 30s now, is that right?
I am.
Are you still thinking about having a family someday?
I am, yes. I got married a couple summers ago, and we're talking about having children and potentially adopting and fostering children. I've always loved children.
Cassie, thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Cassie Underwood is the author of May Cause Love, An Unexpected Journey of Enlightenment After Abortion. Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. Subscribe to the podcast and find out about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.